From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. He's the executive at Adult Swim, who's partly responsible for the existence of the rap duo Run the Jewels.
They're good friends. They both were at my wedding. You know, I mean, we hang out together on vacation, and like, we're just buddies. And it's really great to see two people that I know have been working so hard for so long do so well together when they're ready for it. You know, they're ready at this point in their career for that success.
That's Jason DeMarco, Senior VP and Creative Director of On Air at Atlanta's own Adult Swim. We'll talk with Jason later this hour about how to source and select the perfect music for TV. But we want to know, what are your favorite TV soundtracks or theme songs? Actually, give us a call and let us know at 404-500-9457. You can also post on social media. Remember, we might feature your comments or musical picks on the show. Atlanta is one of the cities making an aggressive bid for Amazon's second headquarters. The Georgia city of Stonecrest even offered to de-annex some land and rename it Amazon. The company's first HQ is in Seattle, Washington, and Seattle has some wisdom to share with other cities who might want to attract the retail giant. A new podcast is called Primed: What Happens When Amazon Comes to Your Town. It's produced by KUOW, Puget Sound Public Radio, and joining me is reporter Joshua McNichols. Hi there.
Hi.
So what made you want to produce this podcast? I mean, how do you know there's enough material?
Oh, man, because if you go to a party or a house gathering in Seattle or an apartment gathering, everybody is talking about the changes brought by Amazon and other tech companies here. I mean, it's all anybody talks about. And so the cultural displacement, the physical displacement, but also the growth and prosperity and the energy, it's just, it defines our conversations right now. So when we heard that Amazon was searching for another HQ2 somewhere and all these other cities were putting in bids, we started to realize we have a lot of perspective on what's happening here, and a lot of the things that we've observed here, the pace of growth, the change, the displacement things, we don't hear any of these other cities talking about those things. So we realized we need to help tell these other cities what they're in for if Amazon comes to their town.
So one of the biggest complaints is gentrification, pricing out the people who've lived in a particular area. And before we hear from this first comment, I want you to explain, give our listeners a geography lesson. Where is Beacon Hill in relationship to the Amazon HQ?
Well, Beacon Hill is actually where Amazon's first headquarters was before it moved to South Lake Union, which is where it has 33 buildings now. But it used to be in this old kind of funky old building when it was much smaller, so it was very close. Beacon Hill was very close to that. It's a minority neighborhood. It has a strong Asian American community there, and it's been that way for a long time. So one thing we found is that neighborhoods dominated by minorities are the largest. They feel the impacts of Amazon's growth the most, because in an environment of scarcity where there's not enough housing for everybody, oftentimes they're the ones to get pushed out first.
So this person we're going to hear from is Austin Monique Subelbia, and she is Filipino-American, so she fits into the community you're talking about. Here's what she had to say.
It almost feels like a battle to, like, save our space, or to, like, say, I'm still here and I still exist. So I feel like it's like, oh, I'm being, like, taken over, but I need to, like, stop the uprising. Like, I need to stand my ground and say I want to be on Beacon Hill, or we all deserve to be on Beacon Hill still with this and not be pushed out.
So that is one perspective. Interestingly enough, I want to play another clip immediately, because this is Deborah Bartlett, and she is a teacher, and she actually lives in the same neighborhood where the new HQ is. It was in Beacon Hill, it's moved, so she's actually in the South Lake Union neighborhood.
And people say, oh, you live in South Lake Union, how's that? It's so vibrant, and it's so exciting, and it's so many things to do. And I say, yes, there's a lot of things to do down there, and I notice them. I feel like I'm an observer, where I walk by, I see people enjoying. It's not me, I'm not doing that, so I'm not really partaking.
So that's not I mean, she's not being pushed out of her home. What is Deborah talking about there, Joshua?
Yeah, so in these two quotes, we're hearing a description of two different kinds of displacement. I mean, on the one hand, you've got somebody who was physically displaced. They could not afford to live in the neighborhood where they had strong cultural ties, so they had to buy a place outside of Seattle. In the other case, in that more recent quote, you heard someone who remains in her neighborhood, or she happens to be in some subsidized housing as a teacher, but she can't participate in the cultural life of the neighborhood, at least not very often. She says, you know, if there's an anniversary or a birthday, they'll splurge and go out to a restaurant. But for the most part, she just sees these things happening around her, and it creates this sense of separation that wasn't there before. So even if you are able to stay, even if you are lucky enough to own a home and can become sort of land rich as property values rise when Amazon comes, it doesn't necessarily mean that you'll have the same relationship with your neighborhood that you used to.
Yeah, I just went to Seattle, actually. I was doing a speech for Amazon, and I went to a restaurant that when I lived in Seattle before, if I had gone on that corner, my dinner would have cost me maybe $30. My dinner was $95 for two people.
Holy cow.
Shocking.
Yeah.
Shocking. But that was not the only change that I noticed. Let's play one more comment. And this is Dave Price, and he drives a truck for a living.
I'm still frustrated. You can hear it in my voice. I was trapped in this labyrinth of concrete. So it's literally like a rat going through a maze and trying to find that piece of cheese. There was really nowhere to go. So I was like breaking all kinds of laws, just trying to get to somewhere that had a little daylight.
So I feel like this is one that people in Atlanta are really going to understand, because since Amazon not only built its HQ in Seattle, but also became an international giant, the traffic has gotten really bad.
Yes, yes. And I mean, I love this guy's quote, because he called us right after this experience. He was on the side of the road, and we kind of arranged to go down there and go to the spot where he was trapped and have him describe it, because this is a feeling that everybody in Seattle and presumably everyone in Atlanta can understand that. And here, one of the problems is that all the resilience has been taken, or the redundancy has been taken out of our transportation system. Right now, we are so packed to the gills on the roads that if one thing happens, if a truck turns over and spills a load of fish on the freeway, as happened here, or a load of bees, as happened in another case, we get these sort of like post-apocalyptic, you know, like when you watch a show about zombies or something, and there's all these cars parked on the freeway and nobody can get through the freeway. That happens, and
the
we
only
have
thing
these
that would make it more apocalyptic is that there's bees everywhere.
Exactly, exactly.
That's pretty nightmarish.
People love to share stories about it. It becomes part of the cultural currency of these conversations now, is to tell the story about the time when it took you like 2 hours to get home this one crazy night, even though you just live like a mile away.
So, now, there is a lot more public transportation. They have built new lines. They've built new trolleys. Has that has not eased the pressure?
Well, it's difficult because it helps a lot, and there are areas where, for example, the buses get a dedicated lane, and in those places things are better. But one issue is that the region has not been able to keep up with the pace of growth. The tax revenues, even though they are important for these, you know, for Metro, which runs the buses, and very helpful, they're not enough to throw as many buses as you'd need to capture all those people. Also, there's a cultural shift that is taking a while to happen of getting people on public transportation instead of in their cars. At the beginning of Amazon's tenancy in the South Lake Union neighborhood, there was still, I believe for a while, Jeff Bezos wasn't giving bus passes to the employees, because one thing I've read about is that he wanted them to be able to leave at any time and not feel constrained by a bus schedule. So there was... An emphasis on cars. That has shifted now. Now they buy bus passes for people. I think they've realized the importance of that. But still, there's a lot of parking spaces in Amazon's headquarters in South Lake Union, and a lot of people still driving in, and the congestion is just insane.
I'm speaking with KUOW reporter Joshua McNichols about how Amazon has changed Seattle. We've been complaining a lot about Amazon, but if you talk to the politicians that represent Seattle and Washington, they say it's by far a net positive when it comes to economic impact. Would you dispute that?
No, I think they're absolutely right. It has been a net positive. The issue is not that prosperity is good. No one disputes that prosperity is good. The issue is that the prosperity is not shared. And one thing we found in Seattle is that any constraints on the sharing of prosperity or any constraints in access to neighborhoods that are prosperous, maybe because people live farther out, it's hard for them to get in, those constraints will begin to define you as a city when Amazon-level growth comes. So what we've seen is, for example, one constraint is the tech industry tends to be dominated by white males. Asian Americans are well represented, too. They tend to get hired but not promoted as much, at least in tech companies in the Silicon Valley, and we presume here at Amazon as well. But African Americans and Hispanics...
I just want to be clear. We don't actually have a lot of the data that we need to be able to understand what's going on with hirings and promotions in Amazon. That's why you made that particular comment, right?
That's right. We don't know a lot. We know they put out some sort of top-level numbers about their diversity statistics. And so some of our observations are anecdotal about what we see here in Seattle because we don't have the in-depth information. And also some of our information comes from an understanding of the tech industry as a whole.
So what is causing, you just mentioned one of the causes, the fact that the diversity among the specific tech jobs that usually pay quite well, as opposed to like secretary or executive decision assistant, et cetera, are oftentimes white males, and they're the most likely to be promoted, we presume. Are there other reasons why the prosperity that Amazon brings is not being shared by the neighborhoods that surround it?
Yeah, I mean, one big reason is that our tech pipeline isn't very diverse. I mean, and that responsibility for that, you could blame the state for that because we haven't really funded our education system to its full potential. We've chronically sort of underfunded it here in Washington State. Other states may not have as much of a problem for that. There are some who say, you know, because Amazon precipitated so much change so quickly, they should take a more active role in developing a more diverse tech pipeline. They should help reach minorities, you know, in kindergarten in order to get them interested in technology. Others say, you know what, this is the state's problem, and you can't blame Amazon for this one problem.
Well, I can almost guarantee Atlanta's not ready for the traffic, but we'll see about the rest of it. That's Joshua McNichols, a reporter with KUOW in Seattle and producer of the new podcast, Primed, What Happens When Amazon Comes to Your Town. Thank you so much, Joshua.
Thank you.
Just ahead, a century and a half later, and some Southerners still want to secede. But first, the musical mastermind behind Adult Swim. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Independent musicians have a real friend in Atlanta, Adult Swim. The popular late-night network buys music from a large number of mostly unknown artists. Adult Swim even had its own record label called William Street Records. It's now Adult Swim Singles. And it licenses new tracks from a whole slew of indie producers. All the music you hear on Adult Swim, from the bumpers to the promos to the show soundtracks, are sourced by one guy. Jason DeMarco is Adult Swim's Senior Vice President and Creative Director of On Air, and he joins me now. Hello there.
Hello.
So first, the first thing that comes to mind, obviously, is that you're very busy.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm lucky enough to have more than one job within my job, but I am very pleasantly busy. Yes. All
like,
the time.
Give me an estimate. How many new bands do you listen to on like a weekly basis?
Well, so I have so much music on my hard drive that I can't do streaming services because just waiting for it to sync with Spotify, my computer crashes.
Wow.
So I'm even.
Holy cow.
Yeah. So I'm one of the only people that probably still buys music. So I probably buy 5 to 7 records a week, every week, pretty much. And that's on an average week.
So, you know, sometimes these corporate collaborations with artists can go really bad.
Yeah. Often.
Yes. I would say more often than not.
Yeah.
So was that in your minds when you first started this?
I mean,
how to avoid it, I mean?
Yeah. I mean, what was in my mind was part of my job is doing partnerships with advertisers. So actually all these music projects were born out of coming up with ideas to involve advertisers to do things that beyond just sponsoring a commercial for a show. And part of what we deal with advertisers is translating the weirdness of Adult Swim through the broadness of your average advertiser message. So through that, I think I learned a lot about how to keep creative sort of firewalled in a way. And I knew that if we were going to do something with musicians, we kind of had to take the same approach.
Sorry, I don't want to interrupt you, but it almost feels as though if it's just coming from an advertising perspective, it would make it harder to create a firewall.
It is. but I had to get the money from somewhere, basically. Before, like, these started by doing extra projects the advertisers would sponsor, and I would use the advertiser money to pay for it. And then once they did well enough and Adult Swim fans kept coming to us and saying, we want more of this, we want more of this. Now we just pay for it out of our own budget for the most part. But it had to prove itself. And I used advertiser money to do that.
So how do you then protect artists from the kind of exploitation that occurs in many of these other corporate collaborations?
We basically keep everything very, very simple. We approach the artist because I already know who they are and I already know what they do, and I am only asking them for a new song that we won't own. We're simply licensing for some period of time. They own it. They will release it on their own however they want. We're only releasing it for a particular window where it's exclusive to us. So going to an artist, it's literally like a bag of money is falling out of the sky to give you to literally do what you're already doing.
Right, to pay you to create something.
To create something you will own, and we are simply licensing, and non-exclusively. So they could even license it to someone else after our little exclusivity period. It's theirs to do with what they will. So it's just such an easy deal for artists. And then when we talk to advertisers, we say, look, the artist is not going to write a song about your product. We're simply approaching them to get a song, and you can help us present it to the public. Because even advertisers are smart enough to know that something good that's free given to, like, anyone on the street is going to leave them with a better impression than something watered down and horrible, or at least a lot of them are smart enough.
Not all of them.
No, not all of them.
Not going to name names.
The ones that want to work with us, maybe, is how I was.
So that must be the philosophy, or I don't want to make assumptions, but the philosophy behind where you began with your record label selling music, and now you give it away. Mm-hmm. So is this process what you're talking about here? Why
sort
that
of.
Happened?
We started the record label because we had done some music projects that were very successful with other labels, and we thought, well, why don't we just try it on our own? Unfortunately, this was around 2007 when the music industry was dying.
Tanked.
So we quickly realized, oh, we can't do this. We're not going to make any money at this. So then we had to step back and say, is it worth doing because people like it? Like, is it enough of a thing people associate with Adult Swim that we should keep doing it? And it turned out the answer was yes. So now we just do it as marketing because we get enough response from it that we know that part of the reason, one of many reasons why the average Adult Swim viewer watches Adult Swim is to discover new things like music.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Jason DeMarco, VP and Creative Director of On Air at Atlanta's own Adult Swim. And let's actually listen to a little music.
Okay.
This is 20 past 4. It's from Noble Oak. So what do you go to the artists with? I mean, do you describe a kind of atmosphere or mood you want, or what do you ask them for?
I really keep it very open, I think. And for me, that's been the best approach, is to go in with no expectations, because some artists will come to me and say, I want to do something really different with you guys than I would normally do. You know, just last week we released a 3-hour song from someone who obviously they couldn't fit a 3-hour song on their own record. So they thought, well, I'll do this. And so there's that. And then the other thing is, I never like telling an artist what to do. And I'm always going to them with the my approach is always, I already know who you are. I know your music and I like it. That's why we're coming to you in the first place. So simply do what you do, whatever that is.
You also release whole albums, and
yes.
and here is one of them. This is a song from the show Metalocalypse.
Club.
Yes, what you said. This is actually the song Thunder Horse by the fictional band Deathlock. I mean, that sounds exactly like something a band named Deathlock would make.
Deathlock was the band Death inside Clock. The show Metalocalypse, which aired for, I think, 4 seasons. Yeah, and we made 4 soundtracks, did a couple tours, and those actually sold pretty well.
But so you actually had to go to a band and convince them to be a fictional band named Deathclaw.
In the case of that show, it's different. It's basically that one of the show creators, Brendan Small, was a metalhead, and he wrote all the music for the show. And the longer he worked on the show, the more we realized this could be its own thing. So then we did a tour where they had custom animation, and the band themselves were blacked out, and you couldn't see them. And it just was sort of like the animated band was playing all the music. And then the longer they did it...
Kind of like the Gorillaz.
Yeah, kind of. I mean, pretty much. And then the longer they did it, fans realized who was really making the music. And so then it started being a little more normal human interaction type stuff. But that was just, you know, when show creators have a particular musical point of view, and most of them do, we sort of, the same way we do with our other marketing stuff, we just let them sort of take it in whatever direction they want to. And obviously metal is one of the, you know, the genres that our fans really enjoy.
So let me play a song that probably a lot of people will recognize. This is the theme song from the Venture Brothers. It's got that dissonance in it that really fits.
Old school 60s style, too. I like it.
Yeah. So then how is the process different when you're just going to a band and saying, okay, we just need you to create something, as opposed to theme music? It seems to me theme music needs a little bit more close collaboration.
Yeah. Theme music will very, very much be a collaboration between whoever the person making the music is and the show creator or the network, depending on who's talking to who. And there's always an approach where we're looking for this particular thing. Do you think you could deliver this style? So those guys knew they wanted a 1960s kind of classic style big band thing, and they went to J.G. Thirlwell, who also records as Fetus, who's a legend, and asked him, we know this isn't something you normally would do. Would you be into this? And sort of he just kept working back and forth with them until they got it to a good place. But it's way more, you know, there's a goal, because the theme show song has to set the tone for what you're about to watch in a way that the things that, like Adult Swim Singles, doesn't have to, because that's just a free song coming out of nowhere. A theme show song has to tell you something about the show.
And that's not short term either. That lives with the show.
Right. And that's the other thing. Even negotiating that takes way longer, because, you know, when you're giving away a song, you're just licensing it for a period of time. But when you're making a theme song, the network has to somewhat own it, and it has to be able to be used for till the end of time in, you know, all media. So it gets complicated depending on who you're, you know, if you're talking to an established artist like J.G. Thirlwell, a fiercely independent established artist, you have to make sure that you're coming to him with the right type of negotiation, or he'll just go, well, I don't want to do that, you know.
Is there a sound to Adult Swim?
So, you know, slowly that one has developed, I think. So I would say most of the music we use falls into 3 categories: electronic music, hip hop, or metal, because those are kind of the genres that through the years we've seen that fans really connect with. And, you know, to be blunt, that's what I listen to mostly. And I'm the person picking all the music. So we do have shows like Squidbillies that delve into country. We have done songs with folk artists, with country artists, with all genres. But for the most part, the vast majority of the music you're going to hear when you turn on Adult Swim is going to be electronic music, hip-hop, or metal of some kind, because those are the three genres that I still think are among the most exciting genres of music that are still changing and coming up with new forms for themselves and on the cutting edge of what can be. And that's kind of what I think, you know, Adult Swim's music should represent that, because I think as a network, we're trying to represent that.
So not much chance for klezmer.
No. Yeah. You're not going to hear much klezmer, probably. I mean, you might, but probably not. I bet we have.
There's a polka slash punk band in Dearborn that, you know.
I know. And I guarantee if you went back through all of our bumps, there was some klezmer or polka used in a bump, but I guarantee it was probably in an ironic way.
So when you are listening to music, even if you like something, are there times when you really like a band, but you know that's not going to work for Adult Swim? And if so, what are you hearing?
Yeah, there are times. I mean, there are times when, you know, most of the music that we're going to be using is either going to go in a show, or it's going to go on in a bump or some sort of packaging element on television, or go in a commercial. And so if it's too slow or too sad, that's going to be rough, because we are a comedy channel and we're not sort of known for our slow dramas. So, you know, when you're watching television, the average viewer, you have to keep in mind that you're going into their home and they might be changing the channel and not knowing what they're about to see. So you have to think about how you're curating that experience. And something really, really slow and dirgy will probably kill the momentum. So that's the kind of thing where I may listen to, you know, a 2-hour ambient noise song, but that doesn't mean I'm going to use it in a promo for the Squidbillies, because it just
would be weird.
It wouldn't make sense. Not weird in a good way, just weird. So those are the reasons why I wouldn't use certain songs, because they just don't feel right for, hey, I'm watching a comedy network, you know.
Do you think that that Adult Swim sort of reflects the city in which it's made?
I would say so. I mean, we did a whole album of Atlanta rap artists being remixed by independent electronic musicians called ATL Remix. We did that like in 2008, way back. We've worked with Mastodon, Atlanta's number one metal band, for a number of years. We've done a bunch of music videos with them. We've featured a number of Atlanta bands pretty much every year on singles. And then we've done albums. And of course, I've personally been involved a lot with Killer Mike of Run the Jewels.
No, wait. Now, there's a story out there that you actually introduced Killer Mike to LP.
Yeah.
That's a true story.
That is a true story.
Like, you're kind of responsible for Run the Jewels.
Yes. I mean, luckily, Mike.
Did you get that engraved, like, on a plaque?
It'll be, I always say it's going to be what's on my gravestone. It's going to be like whatever I've done in my life, that's what people are going to care about, which is fine. That's a good thing to be remembered for, as any. But yeah, Mike and L, I had worked with previously on multiple projects. And when Mike came to me and wanted to do a solo album, we were trying to decide who was going to do the music. And I said, have you heard of this guy LP? And he said, I've heard of him, but I don't really know the music. And so I basically got him to listen to the music. He's like, great, I love this guy. So I called L. L was working on a solo record, and I said, you got to fly down, and I want you to work with Mike on a couple songs for a solo record. And he didn't want to do it because he's a curmudgeon. And I browbeat him into it, and he flew down here, and it was love at first sight. I mean, they spent a day in the studio, recorded three songs, and they walked out. Instantly, there was just an instant connection. So then we decided to make the whole rest of the record with L, and then they went on tour together, and kind of that really set it in stone. But yeah, they're very gracious in that they tell people all the time that I introduce
they
them.
They do, yeah. But you never know if that's just being polite,
sure,
or if it's true.
But they're good friends. They both were at my wedding. You know, I mean, we hang out together on vacation, and like, we're just buddies. And it's really great to see two people that I know have been working so hard for so long do so well together when they're ready for it. You know, they're ready at this point in their career for that success. They know they've seen highs and lows. They know what to do with it. They know how to appreciate it, and they know how to make it last in a way that if this hit when they were 20, I don't know that they would have been able to hold on like they're doing now.
That's such a perfect transition to my next question is what the advice you might have for doing business as a young artist, because I bet you see young artists making mistakes.
Oh, yeah.
Just in the profession.
Yes.
And there's probably common mistakes, right?
Very much so. Yeah.
What are they?
I would say don't have your best friend be your manager. That's a very good first one. Or your wife.
You see that a lot.
I see that a lot, yeah, especially in rap music. I would say read your contracts, read them well, and don't sign any contract that goes beyond two albums. And I would say show up on time, and when you say you're going to do something, do it. Because you'd be surprised how much that happens where someone says, oh, I'm going to do this, and then they don't. And then you have to chase them down so that you can pay them. And it's very simple. It's like just make it easy for someone to work with you so that if they have a good experience, they'll want to do it again. It's very, very simple, but it's a lot harder for people to seemingly get there than you would think.
That's Jason DeMarco, Senior Vice President and Creative Director of On Air at Atlanta-based Adult Swim. They're in the middle of their 52-week-long singles program. They release free music every week. So go to adultswim.com to check out the female rapper Bosco, whose single drops this week. It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Just ahead, Decatur Schools battle over transgender rights. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. By 1861, 11 states had seceded from the United States of America. The Confederacy ended in 1865 with the end of the war, but the ideas behind it remain very much alive. The League of the South is a white nationalist group headquartered in Killen, Alabama, and it wants those same 11 states to leave the United States. After being part of the Charlottesville chaos, its leader, Michael Hill, posted on Facebook, quote, "The South will once again be in name and in actuality white man's land, a place where we and our progeny can enjoy Christian liberty and the fruits of our own labor unhindered by parasitical out-groups," end quote. I talked about this in August with Roxanne Donovan, psychology professor at Kennesaw State University, and also Trey Hood, political science professor at the University of Georgia. Trey, let's start with you because, look, ever since 1865, there have been people calling for the South to secede again. Is there any reason to take these new calls seriously?
You're correct. There have been people that have long talked about seceding. It's all just really silly pie in the sky at this point, or ever since 1865. In addition to ending slavery, of course, the Civil War decided once and for all whether or not a state would be able to voluntarily leave the Union. And the answer was clearly no. So there's really not a whole lot to discuss from my vantage point on this question.
Well, I have lots
we can
more
keep
questions.
Talking,
we're
going to
keep talking because I have more questions. But Roxanne, there are people who are very serious about seceding. And we have seen a rise in militia groups. They are heavily armed, some of them. What kind of state of mind leads to this idea that you would want to secede from your own nation?
So I don't know of any studies that have looked at secessionists themselves, but there are lots of studies that look at prejudice. And they are personality characteristics that predict prejudice as well as on the extreme violence against outgroups. And some of them are right-wing authoritarianism. Despite the name, people on the left and the right can be high on right-wing authoritarian. And what that is authoritarian aggression, so aggressive tendencies towards out-group, authoritarian submission, submission to in-group authorities, and then conformity and traditional values. There's also high social dominance orientation, and that's a belief and an endorsement that some groups are allowed to have more power and more resources, so are able to dominate other groups, and a belief that some groups are more superior than others. And there are also a bunch of other things that can lead people to more extreme viewpoints and to have prejudice ideology. So an external threat. And for many people, Barack Obama is president, so a black man is president, was a threat. And then you saw a rise in hate groups and hate crime and aggression. The belief that you are a victim of potential inequality. So your group that's on top and those on the higher ends of the social group hierarchy are more likely to endorse right-wing authoritarianism and social dominance orientation. So when they believe that equity is about to happen, so out-groups are about to gain footholds of fairness and equality with the higher order social group, then all of a sudden that in and of itself becomes threatening.
Right. Okay. So, Trey, let me go back to you, because even if it's illegal, right, for a state to secede, I can't imagine a lot of people are worried that an entire southern state will secede, right? But we have seen instances of times when either militias or communities have decided to so-called reclaim their territory. A classic example is just about 40 miles north of Atlanta in Forsyth County, where the whites, through violence and intimidation, basically ran all of the African Americans out of that county. So is there something short of a state's secession that could be of concern?
Well, possibly. I don't know that it's necessarily related to the question of secession. I mean, these right-wing radical groups are going to be there one way or the other, whether they're talking about secession or not. It's just become sort of a knee-jerk reaction from some of these groups. You know, whether or not it's possible, or they think it's possible, to secede really doesn't matter in terms of, it's not going to change their ideological viewpoints. So I was talking about secession in terms of, I mean, there are still a lot of people who perhaps think that it's possible for a state to secede, but of course the answer is no at this point, or has been for 150 years now. Or really, I guess you could argue it has been for since 1789, once the Constitution was ratified, because states could voluntarily opt into the Constitution but cannot voluntarily opt out. Now, of course, the Southern states in the Civil War, or just prior to the Civil War, argued that they could opt out. But again, the answer clearly was no from what occurred during the Civil War. So
Roxanne, that brings us back to you. Let me play you this comment. This is an unnamed white supremacist protester who's in Tennessee, and from a video he uploaded to YouTube.
The Southern people, as a native group of organic culture, I mean, they deserve the right to exist, just like any other native people around the world have a right to have their own country.
And let me play you one more. Again, this is Michael Hill. He's leader of the secessionist group League of the South.
The Bible talks about nations, and it means peoples, tribes, clans, groups of individuals that are connected by blood. So when we talk about the Southern nation, we're talking about not political entities. We're talking first and foremost about our people. And who are our people? Our people are white European Southerners.
Roxanne, you're a psychology professor. What are you hearing there?
So, a disclaimer, I haven't treated any of these individuals, so I can't tell what's in their minds, but I can tell you what research suggests. And what you're hearing is that social dominance orientation, which in this manifestation looks like white supremacy. So my group is better than your group, and thus my group should be allowed to exist.
Is that different from them just, let's say that their response was, and this has come from an interview I've done, but this, what if their response was, I'm not talking about white supremacy, I'm saying I should be allowed to live with the people that are part of my so-called tribe.
Right. That same isolationist view is about white supremacy, that other groups are less than, and thus I should be allowed to isolate with my group because we will thrive as a result of not having multiculturalism and diversity. So, I mean, you can use euphemisms for it and say it's about white nationalism, but at the crux of it, it's about white supremacy.
Trey, was there anything that any party, any leader could have done along the way to address secessionism and put the question to bed in the past 150 years?
Well, I think there have been efforts to do that. Again, it seems to be secession seems to be a knee-jerk reaction sometimes from Southerners in relation to a lot of different historical events. And again, I think there's some misunderstanding among possibly some individuals out there that, it is possible still to secede, which is, again, not. So
I think that extreme ideas can have a foothold. It can go from the mainstream, from the margins to the mainstream. And I think part of what's important is that we understand that. I mean, we can hold the belief that there are rules and there are laws to prevent it, but they were rules and laws in place that should have prevented the secession movement to begin with. And what I'm worried about is these extreme ideas and ideological violence is moving from the margins to the mainstream.
Okay, it's interesting you say that, because here I'm going to play you a comment from somebody who's in the Cal Exit movement, just so we don't think this is only about Southerners. We only have about a minute and a half left, but he's talking about California's possible secession, and here he is on Fox News.
We are going to do things that are going to be beneficial for our state, and we disregard what the United States thinks or even their laws. For example, our marijuana, sanctuary cities. We just, if it's good for the state, we're going to do it, regardless of what the federal law is.
Is that the same mindset that you're talking about in terms of isolationism?
It's about isolationism, but I think the motives behind California wanting to secede is very different than the motives behind the South wanting to secede. But the means of let's just go on our own and create some extreme movement so that we don't have to deal with other people with different ideas is the problem. I mean, at the end of the day, there are always going to be some on the side of inequity, violence, and domination. And there's going to be some on the other side about equity, peace, and cooperation. For the majority of us in the middle, though, we're going to bend with the prevailing winds. And that's the scary part, right? Depending on whether we're in a space where our leaders, our parents, our community say, okay, difference is deficit. Diversity is bad. Let's just make sure that we isolate to prevent ourselves from that. Or difference is about diversity and it's good, and let's promote peace, equity, and love.
That is Roxanne Donovan. She's professor of psychology at Kennesaw State University, and Trey Hood is political science professor at UGA. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you, Claire.
Thank you.
Transgender rights are a national issue this year. President Donald Trump tried to ban trans Americans from serving in the military, but that measure was blocked by a federal judge. Here in Georgia, another debate unfolds in City of Decatur schools. At a September school board meeting, a parents group criticized a policy that protects transgender students in Decatur. Those parents have launched a petition to rescind the policy put in place by Superintendent David Dude last year. Fernadette Broyles is an attorney representing the parents in the petition, and she brings us this commentary explaining their perspective.
The Board of Education of the City Schools of Decatur has breached the trust of parents in the community. In July 2016, Superintendent David Dude created a radical new policy requiring that bathrooms, locker rooms, showers, sports teams, and overnight accommodations be open to students experiencing gender dysphoria. He did so based on unconstitutional guidance from the Obama administration that was halted in a lawsuit by Georgia and other states, and has since been rescinded. It is not difficult to understand why parents in the city schools of Decatur are deeply troubled. This policy would cause their children to undress, shower, toilet, and possibly sleep overnight in spaces with students of the opposite biological sex. Despite knowing the importance this policy would have for parents and students, the superintendent and school board chose to implement it without first informing parents. This may have violated Georgia Sunshine Laws, requiring public officials to conduct their business in the light of day. But it was also a clear breach of the trust of parents and students these officials were elected to serve. This policy threatens students' right to privacy and to not have their unclothed bodies be viewed by members of the opposite anatomical sex. It also violates constitutionally protected parental rights and potentially free speech rights. Public schools should not be allowed to instill the unproven ideals of a gender-fluid society, and certainly not against the will of parents. Parents opposing this policy are also concerned about the gender dysphoric children themselves. Medical professionals have raised alarms that affirming the discordance some children feel with their bodies poses risks to children's long-term well-being. Dosing them with puberty blockers and cross-sex hormones has never been medically proven to be safe and effective. On April 10, the CSD school board had the opportunity to do the right thing and return the district to the pre-existing policy that struck a sensible balance for a decade. Instead, the school board abdicated its responsibility and left the new anti-privacy policy effectively in place. It is not too late for the CSD school board to reverse that error, however, and to return City Schools of Decatur to protecting privacy and fairness for all its children.
That was Vernadette Broyles, an attorney representing some parents who are speaking out against a policy that protects transgender students in Decatur. Linda Ellis is executive director of the Health Initiative, an LGBT advocacy group, and she tells us why those protections should stay in place.
The Hebrew word shalom can mean normalcy. Normalcy is peace. It is wholeness, fitting into your space, everything as it is supposed to be. Everyone craves normalcy, though not everyone expects to find it. These days, as I stretch myself to appreciate the experiences of transgender people and their families, I recognize a familiar desire for normalcy. I see parents afraid to hope that normalcy is possible for their kids because so many of us react to trans folks out of fear or ignorance in a way that does real harm to their children. Research regarding trans youth is not easy to read. It describes challenges to mental health, including increased anxiety, social withdrawal, and suicide risks, as trans kids are subjected to misunderstandings and harassment every day. Yet even the smallest offers of support significantly improve the outcomes for trans youth. Something as simple as being able to safely use the bathroom at school, or being called by the right name or pronoun, can be life-changing. It can decrease bullying and lead to a greater sense of normalcy for trans kids. Grades improve, behavior problems and social anxieties decrease, and friendships develop. Since 2006, the City Schools of Decatur's non-discrimination policy has included gender identity. Over the years, parents and school leaders have worked to make our schools safe and supportive places for all students. Recently, some in the community challenged our system's policy and the superintendent's guidance on how to comply with it. There was a significant community response, and both sides made their plans to go to the school board to argue their case. And then something remarkable happened. Parents who love their trans kids agreed to meet with parents who love their cisgender kids to listen to and learn from each other. And then, with differing views of politics and faith aside, we all found that we agreed on one thing. We want all of our kids to have the best possible opportunities. We want them to feel supported and accepted as they are, to be their best, to find happiness, and to be kind. We want them to have good, normal lives. We want shalom. I know that it's going to take more than credible research and supportive policies to transform other into normal. It takes courage and patience and a willingness to listen. There's a lot to learn, a lot of hard conversations to have. It'll be challenging for us to remember that we're all fighting for the same thing in the end, a community in which our kids feel normal, feel shalom. I'm hopeful that we're on the right track in Decatur.
That was Linda Ellis, Decatur parent and executive director of the Health Initiative. And that's our show for today, but we'd love to hear from you. We talked earlier this hour about Amazon's HQ, second HQ. It may or may not come to Georgia. Do you think Atlanta will land Amazon? Why or why not? You know how to reach us. Call us at 404-500-9457 and leave a message or post on Facebook or Twitter. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headley. Have a great day.